Okay, it's time to begin our Wednesday night broadcast for our Bible class at the Eastside Church in Russellville, Alabama. We thank you for joining us, and we encourage you to contact us, send us a direct message on Facebook if you have any questions about this class or our services. Service times are a little unusual for a lot of churches. Because of all that's going on with the coronavirus. But, you know, whatever question you may have, contact us on Facebook. Also, you can go to our website, eastsidechurchrussellville.com. That is one word, eastsidechurchrussellville.com. You can find recordings of the classes that we've been doing this quarter and the quarter before, and sermons and resources and other ways to contact us. And so once again, I just want to thank you for joining us. We're going to be in the book of Nehemiah tonight, starting in chapter 1. We are about to wind down our study of the captivity and the return from captivity. And I will just go ahead and say to those of our members who are regularly going through these classes that the next few weeks would probably be a good time to practice some of your memory work. I know that when we were doing the prophets, and going through Esther, even that is quite a bit of reading that kind of keep up with, and so maybe a little bit more than typical. But I hope that we were able to keep up with it because that was important. But I do think we should have some time to maybe catch up on some of our memory work if we've gotten behind. And what we're going to do this evening is we're going to talk about the dates a little bit just to kind of set the time for Nehemiah, because a little bit of time does pass between the end of Ezra and the beginning of the book of Nehemiah. So we will talk about the dates, but I wanted to take some time to go over our genealogies. And they're right here on the screen, so we can just kind of say them out loud, practice together. If you want to, test your memory, look away from the screen and just kind of practice with us and see how you do. So I'm going to go ahead and go through the genealogy from Adam to Noah. Adam, Seth, Enosh, Canaan, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, and Noah. All right, moving on to Shem, to Abraham. Shem, Arphaxad, Selah, Eber, Peleg, Reu, Serug, Nahor, Terah, and Abram. Moving on to Abraham to David. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, Perez, Hezron, Ram, Aminadab, Nashon, Salmon, Boaz, Obed, Jesse, and David. And then finally, the last one that we've been working on since our study of the divided kingdom, Solomon to Jeconiah. And next quarter, going into the life of Christ, we will go ahead and finish this genealogy from Adam to Jesus. So Solomon to Jeconiah. Solomon, Rehoboam, Abijah, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Jehoram, Ahaziah, Joash, Amaziah, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, Manasseh, Amon, Josiah, Jehoiakim, and Jeconiah. You probably remember that when we were doing the kings that we had Athaliah here as the daughter of Ahab, who momentarily usurped the throne in Judah. And in our list of the kings, Jehoahaz comes after Josiah. But in the genealogy of Christ, we go from Josiah to Jehoiakim to Jeconiah. Okay, so that's a little bit of a review for us. And remember, that's like a second timeline for us. We've been memorizing those 17 periods. They you know, become, you know, little boxes maybe for us to put information in about, you know, periods in history. They help us to line up the events. They help us to see the story of God bringing Jesus into the world, you know, as one big picture, one big plan. And these genealogies can kind of serve the same purpose. As we go through those, you know, a lot of these names, particularly in the kingdom, a lot of these names we recognize. We remember some of the things that happened during their reigns as kings. So, you know, just kind of working on organizing the information. We want to, you know, to have depth of the story. But to have depth, we really need to lay a good foundation, and we need that repetition. And depth, I believe, in my experience, depth comes from after you have laid the foundation, you have had some meaningful repetitions, depth begins to come. As we continue to go through that material, connections begin to be made as our, you know, knowledge from period to period expands, and we see writers, you know, referencing periods. We see the Exodus become a theme throughout the scriptures, the idea of God, you know, delivering his people from Egypt, even in the Gospels, as we'll soon see. You know, Jesus was set forth as kind of, you know, ushering in a new Exodus in which he's going to lead his people out of the captivity of sin. And so we begin to kind of see those connections, and, you know, and definitely the apostles help us to be deepened in our understanding of the scriptures, because they're constantly quoting from the prophets and showing these connections, how they pointed to the coming of Christ. So one of the reasons that the Old Testament history continues to be practical to us is because so many of the generic principles, you know, translate just directly to the way that we serve God today. We often make the point that the Jews served God under a different covenant, but it was the same God. It was a God who loved justice and mercy and holiness. And while there may have been, you know, different distinctions under the old law to set the people apart from those around them, there is a need to respect holiness. There is certainly a need to respect authority. There's a need to be, you know, careful, to listen carefully to God, to seek to do all that we can to obey him carefully, to trust in his mercy and grace, to know that as hard as we may, you know, as hard as we may work, without God's help, without God's forgiveness, we all have fallen short of the glory of God. And that was, you see that, we tend to think, I think a lot of times, of when we think of law keepers, maybe we think of the Pharisees, and we see their arrogance. And Jesus confronted them and rebuked them for their arrogance. In Ezra and Nehemiah, we have seen people who were concerned about keeping the law, but they were so humble. They knew that they needed God's mercy to fill in the gaps, that they had fallen short, that their fathers had fallen short. And when they found themselves in distress and despair, they knew it wasn't because God was somehow, you know, deficient. God had stopped being faithful. They knew that the problem, you know, lie with themselves. And we see that in Ezra's prayer. We're going to see it in Nehemiah's prayer as we look today in chapter 1. So this is actually generally believed to be a portion of the wall that was built during the time of Nehemiah. A lot of excavation has been done around Jerusalem. It's one of the most, you know, I guess, as from an archaeological standpoint, it's one of the most, I guess, interesting places. You know, there's been an interest in excavating there and uncovering and discovering, and is generally thought that, you know, you see these square stones up above here where there has been some, maybe a more refined process of stone cutting for these later repairs, or later even maybe additions to the fortifications. You see how they stand in contrast to these maybe less smooth stones. And it's generally thought to be that this is at least a portion of the wall that was, you know, that was built during the days of Nehemiah in 445 BC. That's 2,500 years ago almost. That's pretty incredible to think about. But, you know, many things from the first century and beyond have been uncovered. And a lot of times, more and more, you're able to find good pictures on the internet of these things. You got to, you know, do a little checking and cross-checking and make sure that you've got, you know, reliable material. But generally, you can find a lot of interesting pictures of archaeological sites. I know that Leon Malden has a lot of pictures that he is happy for people to use on his website. Leon's message board, generally, it's a little bit of a strange address, if I remember correctly. But if you search Leon's message board, generally, you'll be able to find his website, I believe. And you just, if he has a picture in an article, just kind of double click on the picture and it will open it full size. And he wants people to use those pictures. He asks that you credit his site or him. If you use his picture, that you just let people know that it was the photo was taken by Leon Malden. But just a lot of, you know, incredible material out there available to see some of that stuff, even if you're not able to go. And, you know, so that's pretty special and exciting. If you'll look here, here's the dates that we've been talking about. And I hope this is, I may redo this. As I was looking at this today, I felt like it was maybe a little busy, but hopefully we can kind of see these points along the way. First year of Cyrus, 538 BC, that is when Zerubbabel and that large group of captives who came back with him, that was in 538 BC. And so you see that date there marked out. This is kind of supposed to be a timeline of sorts. Here is when the building resumed after it had stopped for so long. The building resumed in 520 BC, and the temple was finally completed in 516 BC. Here is where Esther fits into the time of the return. The third year of Ahasuerus is when her story begins, 484 BC, around about there. And then the seventh year of Artaxerxes is when Ezra came back. We were talking a little bit about that story, 458 BC. And then finally here, Nehemiah's return, 445 BC. So these are the dates that I asked you to remember, basically the beginnings of the people who came back to Jerusalem, 538 BC, 458 BC, and then finally 445 BC. So I want to go ahead and get into, and here's a picture of the walls that you can see, that hopefully you can see that with some detail on your screen, and we're going to be using that, but we need to go ahead and get into the text. In chapter 1, it says that men came to Susa, the capital, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, and that's where we get our date here, and another date it is given later. And Nehemiah asks about how things are going in Judah and Jerusalem, and of course we know that the messengers told Nehemiah that the people were in distress and reproach. The walls of the city were broken down and the gates were burned with fire. And he says in verse 4, "When I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven." So just a few points that we make here before we go on. First of all, I think we probably understand that the wall of the city was, you know, one of the most basic lines of defense. And for a city to have, you know, breached walls, it left the people, you know, there wasn't a lot of security from attackers, from criminals. It would probably maybe be akin to, say, today, suddenly we no longer had access to the 911 emergency system. You know, we take it for granted. It's such a basic, safety, net that's kind of built into our culture. And that's the way I think probably we should think about the walls of the city. It was where people fled for refuge in dangerous times. It was, the gates were generally closed at night to keep undesirables out, and the gates would be guarded, during the day. So, there was a layer of protection between those who were trying to do what's right and those who would, do harm. So it's a big deal. And you can see Nehemiah's grief, his concern over the people. And this is one question that, you know, it just kind of has come into my mind going through this time. The question of whether or not any work had been done on the wall before this time. And I think our answer to this question would depend on how we understand Ezra chapter 4. And more as I look at Ezra chapter 4, when you remember that list of complaints were basically documented there. And there was, you know, there was a complaint in the days of Ahasuerus, a complaint in the days of Artaxerxes. There's basically two different theories. And, you know, we're trying to reconstruct history here. I think both of them have merit. And I don't think that either one of them change our view of Nehemiah very much. But there is a theory that Ahasuerus and Artaxerxes were being used as titles there. And basically that they, you know, they go directly from Cyrus to Darius. And so that is a timeline that goes from Cyrus to Darius and explaining that the temple work eventually stopped. So that's one theory, that it's basically just linear. Another theory is that Ahasuerus and Artaxerxes and Ezra 4 are the kings of Esther and the book of Nehemiah. So that what you have in Ezra 4 is documentation that the opposition of the Samaritans continued even through to the reign of Artaxerxes. And so what the picture that would paint for us is that that some significant work had probably been done on the wall, but in the days of Artaxerxes, the Samaritans came up with another plot to oppose the Jews and interfere with their work. And maybe even as they went with force of arms to stop the work, that they went even further than the decree had specified and actually, you know, did some damage and destruction to the wall. So that is kind of the picture that, you know, that's the view of things that I'm kind of leaning toward right now. But either way, I don't think it changes much about our view of the book of Nehemiah. One thing to consider, you know, again, this is just me maybe offering some evidence why I would take this view. There's a couple of, you know, references to the work on the walls in some of the complaints that were documented in Ezra 4. And then in Ezra 9 in verse 9, as Ezra is praying, one of the things that he talks about God doing that was good was that he had given us reviving to raise up the house of God, to restore its ruins, and to give us a wall in Judah and Jerusalem. So one of the good things that Ezra speaks of as God having already done was that he had given, you know, the city security and rebuilt, had the walls rebuilt. So either way, the Samaritans are enemies and constant interferers, it seems, because even if Ezra 4 is not documenting ongoing Samaritan interference, Sanballat was a Samaritan, and he is a leader in the opposition to what's going on when Nehemiah comes to Jerusalem. So about verse 4, one of the things I wanted to think about with you is the fact that he responded to the report with mourning, fasting, and prayer. And he sat down for many days, which indicates to me that he was thinking deeply about the source of Jerusalem's distress and what to do about it. And the only reason I wanted to mention that is because I think probably I find myself, and maybe this describes you as well, I find myself wanting distress to end as quickly as possible. And, you know, I just immediately, you know, jump into action. I'm going to stop this. I'm going to respond to this. And I wonder if maybe I could make things worse at times by not being more like Nehemiah. Taking time to reflect, taking time to mourn about, you know, the situation, the bad aspects of the situation, and taking time to think about some questions that will really help me, you know, get to where I want to be with God, most importantly, and maybe help me, you know, get to a place where I can find relief from this distress. And here are some of the questions that I think we see Nehemiah kind of contemplating in the prayer that is recorded here. Is God angry with us? What will we need to change even as we ask God for help? we ought to know enough about God that when we ask for help, there's an understanding that if I realize something in my life that is amiss, that if I'm going to, you know, to ask God for help, that there is the expectation that I'm going to respect and honor what God says about what he wants for me and how he wants me to live. So what will I need to change even as I ask for God to help? And what work will be required of us as we petition for help from heaven? So we're going to ask God for help. James tells us to ask for wisdom. Do we think that we just ask for wisdom and never crack open our Bibles, never think deeply about the mysteries of Scripture that we encounter sometimes, or the hard questions? I mean, what do we think would be involved in asking for wisdom? I definitely believe that God is able to give us wisdom, because James tells us to ask for wisdom. But as I think about that, okay, well, what might be required on my part to get there? And so I think we see Nehemiah contemplating all these questions in his prayer. And so that just caused me to kind of stop and think, you know, how many times do I just jump up and react to something rather than taking the time to pray, to appeal to God, to think about the situation? What is the problem? What's causing the problem? And what might be required of me to help bring it about, to help bring about a resolution, even as I ask for God's help? One of the things I want you to notice in Nehemiah's prayer, similar to Ezra, no problem on God's part. Nehemiah saw God as absolutely faithful. And in acknowledging that faithfulness, he brings up the conditional nature of our relationship. Now, of course, God grants many blessings unconditionally. But from the standpoint of actually having a relationship with God and having favor, you know, and being able to expect God's help, that is a conditional relationship. And so in verse five, Nehemiah says, "I beseech you, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who preserves the covenant and loving kindness for those who love him and keep his commandments." God preserves the covenant. That is not a question. He is faithful. The question is, do I love him? Am I acknowledging his commandments, being aware of my weaknesses, asking for help, resolving to change, and bringing my will into submission to the king? Let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant, which I am praying before you now, day and night, on behalf of the sons of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the sons of Israel. I and my father's house have sinned. Just like Ezra, you know, Nehemiah is in Persia, but just like Ezra, he takes ownership for the problems that were in Jerusalem. And I think maybe the fact that Judah was in distress, Nehemiah infers from that there's probably some spiritual problems. And even as he plans to try to be a part of the solution and asks God to help him be a part of the solution, he cannot help but acknowledge his own weaknesses. He cannot help but acknowledge how much he will need God's help, because I have sinned and my father's house have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments. Why? You know, what's going on? You know, sometimes people are taken aback by some type of surprising tragedy. And for a moment, they are reeling and they say, God, what's going on? Nehemiah doesn't seem to be caught off guard. He has had time to think and to realize, I'm pretty sure I know what the problem is. It doesn't lie with God. It lies with us. But God, we are acknowledging this now. Help me to be part of the solution. And in particular, he asks at the end of verse 11 there, he asks that that you would make your servant successful today and grant him compassion before this man. And we are told there at the end of verse 11 that Nehemiah was the cupbearer to the king. And so the prayer kind of brings us forward. Nehemiah was praying for about 4 months And the reason we know that is in chapter 2 and verse 1, it was the month Nisan, which was the first month of the, you know, the Hebrew religious calendar. Well, the report had come in Chislev, and back in verse 1, which was the ninth month of the Hebrew calendar. So from the ninth month to the first month, and, you know, it's about 4 months in there. The prayer kind of brings us forward to where Nehemiah has resolved, this is the day I'm going to approach the king. There were many, many other prayers that must have been uttered in those 4 months. But chapter 1 just kind of brings us forward. This is the day I'm going to petition the king. I'm going to look for an opportunity. Lord, give me the opportunity and give me favor in the sight of the king. And so if you'll look in chapter 2 there, going on into chapter 2, it says that he was doing his service as the king's cupbearer. He was there before Artaxerxes, and the wine was before him, and I gave it to the king, and I had not been sad in his presence, which is kind of amazing. For 4 months, he had been able to, you know, he's going about his day. He's having to deal with this. But I think probably part of his sadness and part of his fear is, you know, the day has come. He has resolved not to wait any longer. And, you know, he's not, you know, when the door opens, he's going to have to make the most of it, but because the things that he asks for, he's probably, you know, this is the king of Persia. And while Nehemiah is a high-ranking official and probably respected and trusted, you don't get to make these kinds of requests just, you know, often. And so this is an opportunity. He's going to have to make the most of it. And that seems to maybe explain some of his sadness and his fear at this particular time when he's talking to the king about the thing that has been on his mind for so long. The king can tell that Nehemiah is distressed, and he can tell, he knows that Nehemiah is not sick. He says, this is nothing but sadness of heart. He says, I was very much afraid. Now, there are some who suggest that part of that fear may be that this, you know, expressions of sorrow in the presence of the king was contrary to the royal etiquette, and that it may very well have been a punishable offense. So maybe that is part of the reason he's afraid. But it may also be that he realizes the seriousness of the moment, that this is important to him. He's prayed, he's fasted, you know, and, you know, what will the Lord decide? What will be the spirit of the king toward his request? And so he tells him about the city of his fathers lying desolate. Its gates have been burned with fire. How can I not be sad? And, you know, as we have seen so often in this period, when those who put their trust in God and they make every, you know, this was not some flippant thing. 4 months had been spent praying about this and thinking about this. And yet we see an incredible response. It wasn't even, Nehemiah didn't even ask. The king opened the door and asked Nehemiah, what is it that you would request? And Nehemiah went through that door boldly with faith in the providence of God. He says, if it would please you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. Here's a man who's, you know, not just coming up with some plan for someone else. Again, he wants to be part of the solution. Send me. And it says that the king asked him how long he would be, when will you return? So he gave him a time. This is someone who has thought about what is going to be required. He has been thinking, he is ready for this moment. He goes on to say in verse 7, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me for the governors of the provinces beyond the river, that they may allow me to pass through. And also a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress, which is by the temple, for the wall of the city, and for the house to which I will go. And the king granted them to me because of my excellency of speech. Right? No, that's not what it says. The king granted them to me because of the good hand of my God upon me. So there's a couple of things that I want to look at. First of all, It's so quick in verse 4, you might miss it. It's sometimes been called the arrow prayer. In verse 4, so I prayed to the God of heaven. What would you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. Now, from verse 4 to verse 5, the dialogue does not really seem to be interrupted. And generally what is thought here is that Nehemiah did not, you know, leave the room and go bow his head or fold his hands, but that in a moment, you know, inwardly, he restated his faith in God and, you know, his desire, God, you know, please let me be able to do something to affect the situation in Jerusalem. And just so quickly, you know, before he even opens his mouth, one more time, God, I'm trusting you. And, you know, the challenge for me, I think, was, wow, do I live that way? Do I show that I believe in the power of prayer and the value of prayer the way Nehemiah did? Just in that moment, inwardly. And it tells us about, you know, prayer. You know, there are times for all kinds of prayer. There's time for laying down. There's time for going into the closet. There's time for bowing our heads together. But when we don't have that time, prayer is still valuable, powerful, and necessary. Nehemiah believed that. It's the only thing that explains his actions. And I will also say that Nehemiah said that the king granted his request because of God's good hand. It is evident that Nehemiah had been thinking about what he could do. It is evident that Nehemiah was willing to work. But Nehemiah recognized that he needed to, as he was willing to work, that whatever he was able to do would only be possible by God's help. Every good thing that happens, the Lord did it. It was the good hand of God that was upon us. We see that in Ezra. We see that in Nehemiah. So in verses 9 and 10, Nehemiah arrives in Jerusalem with soldiers and letters, and immediately we are introduced to the major enemies of the Jews who have been causing so much problems recently. But at this time, they're not going to be able to bear arms against the Jews, because Nehemiah has come with Persian soldiers and he's come with official letters from the king. There seems to be some evidence that Sanballat was some type of a Persian official for the Samaritans. He was a Samaritan, so we'll probably think of him maybe as the equivalent of Nehemiah. Eventually, Nehemiah will be described as the governor of Judah. And so Sanballat seems to be his equivalent over the Samaritans, and Tobiah seems to be Nehemiah's equivalent over the Ammonites. And another man is a part of the conflict later, a man named Geshem, who seems to be, you know, the governor of the Arabs, so to speak. But there's no resisting the Jews at this time with force, because it is clear that Nehemiah has come from Persia and he has the king's authority to do what he is doing. But Sanballat is introduced there, and Tobiah, and it says they were displeased that someone had come to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel. So let's kind of look in verses 11 through 16. And now maybe I can give you a picture of, you know, we're basically, you know, now all this wall, if I understand correctly, all this wall and all these towers have not been excavated, but there are enough kind of landmarks that have been excavated. And even maybe from historical records, you will be able to find a lot of pictures of the old city that looks like this. That kind of, you know, here you've got the original very small city, kind of sometimes described as the city of David, the original city expanded to, you know, the king's house and the temple on this mountain in the days of Solomon, and, you know, just kind of built out and expanded. Probably most of this was done during the days of Solomon, so far as the expanding of territory and the building projects that were undertaken to expand and fortify the city. But other kings were building and kind of patching and repairing all along the way. We read about that. But you'll notice it says he was there for 3 days and he arose in the night. I and a few men with me, I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem. And there was no animal with me except the animal on which I was riding. So he says, I went out at night by the valley gate. And he says, on my way to the refuse gate or the dung gate here. So he basically went out on this corner and went this direction toward the dung gate. And he's looking at the walls. And it talks about him going up to the fountain gate in verse 14. And he makes a point of saying in verse 14, he thought about, going in maybe to examine some of these interior areas. And it does seem that some interior work was done when the wall begins. It's kind of hard to be sure, but it does seem to be what's described. But he couldn't even go through the gate with his animal. You're just kind of, all he could do was kind of survey and see. There was no going in, or it was just a pile of a mess. The fountain gate was just a mess. And it says, there's no place for my mountain to pass. He went up by night in verse 15 by the ravine and inspected the wall. And I entered the valley gate again and returned. So it seems that he's kind of mostly maybe inspecting this section, which may be where the worst of the damage is. It would be one way to explain that. But he comes out, the fountain gate's a mess, kind of looks down, through the valley of the Kidron Valley here, inspecting the wall, and then comes back and goes in by the same gate that he had gone out. And basically, it says he did not tell anybody what he was doing. He did not tell the officials where he had gone. He did not tell anybody, even those who, had been doing some work on the wall. He did not tell them his plans. And I would say that probably what we see Nehemiah doing is something we're familiar with ourselves. And it's maybe something that we need to talk about as a practice that should probably be practiced, or at least a practice that is wise and prudent. Nehemiah, it seems, was arming himself with knowledge about the situation. He had heard reports, but now he is seeing firsthand what's going on. What is the work going to be like? What's going to be needed? Of course, he's got permission from the king to secure materials for the gates in particular, repairing them and setting them up. But what's the work? What's it actually look like? What's the work going to take? And he's arming himself with knowledge and a plan. And I would say that he's probably doing that to be ready to answer any objections that may be offered. There are probably some people who cared about Jerusalem who would have said, now is probably not a good time to try to rebuild the walls. Right now, all the power and favor seems to be on the side of the Samaritans and the Ammonites, and we'll just wait till a better time. We'll wait for a more convenient time. But just like Ezra stood out there in the rain and said, we need to make a plan right now. We can't walk away today without a plan because this is serious. The need is urgent. Nehemiah didn't wait for that more convenient time. There are people who are going to be scared once the work starts. They're going to be scared because they're going to be threatened and intimidated by the Samaritans and the Ammonites. And so Nehemiah is getting all his information together, getting his plan together so that he can be ready to answer objections. And sometimes I think that maybe we expect, we think a good idea, an idea is good, and we kind of halfway have worked it out in our mind. And it's not just maybe, in the work of local churches and maybe dealing with local churches, or trying to present an idea to the elders, the leaders of a local church. Sometimes I think we think an idea is good and we've kind of halfway thought about it, and then we present it and some objections are offered, and we're not really prepared to answer those objections, and the idea kind of dies. I think that's just kind of how things have always worked. And it seems to me that maybe Nehemiah is anticipating that. He knows what the work is. He knows what's needed. He's going to make an appeal, and a spiritual appeal, really. The reproach of the city, are we just going to keep letting the city sit here and reproach. And the implication, the unstated implication, was probably, what does that say about the glory of God? Do we not believe that our God can be powerful to help us accomplish this project? And so I would just say that it's not underhanded to flesh an idea out, maybe even to talk about an idea with some people before you present it to the group. And this would be true maybe at the workplace as well, that you hear some objections and you think about it, and you go ahead and you figure out how to answer those objections, and you anticipate those objections. And it is very likely that if that is the case, that if we go through that process, that people are going to understand that, this is not, some halfway idea, that this is, this may require some effort, but some thought has been put into it. A plan to begin has been, I guess, conceived. And it's just a matter of, is this a good thing? Would this be a good thing? Do we need this? Would this help us? And if the answers are yes, 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 then the objections just become a matter of, we will work through those things and make this work, because from what we can see, it's going to be good. We need it. So, work can, let me just read the end of chapter 3 here before we go on, to see how Nehemiah encourages the people. You see the situation, the bad situation, he says, we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates burned with fire. Let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach. And it's at this point. So he reveals his plan. I've seen the wall. Let me tell you what has happened up to this point to get me here. The good hand of my God, favorable toward me. Let me tell you what the king has granted me by the good hand of my God. And when the people hear these things, it is them who are now saying, let us arise and build. So they put their hands to that good work. Of course, Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem, even though they are not able to resist this work by force, they are not willing to let it go on with no opposition. So they mock them. They threaten them. And I think that word, are you rebelling against the king? That word would have been particularly intimidating because they had used that charge to stop the work in the past. The Samaritans had used that. They will rebel if they rebuild the city. And the king came and agreed to stop the work. And so Nehemiah answered them. He didn't stop. He didn't say, well, yeah, you're probably right. We don't, guys, what have we gotten ourselves into? We're in over our head. No, he says, he appeals to the authority of God, which is, that's where we start. That's where we, base every practice on that. And if it is based on the authority of God, we do not give in or give up. The God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build, but you have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem. So there's two things I want to say here before we go into chapter 3. First of all, work is work. It's hard. It's challenging. If we think about it long enough, we're all coming up with reasons perhaps why we can't do this. We don't need to do this. But work can be encouraged. In spite of how hard it may be, people can be encouraged to work by faith, optimism, planning, listening to one another. All these things can encourage work as we sit around. Okay, we have decided this will be good for us. We've got some questions. We got some objections. Let's sit down and nail these. Let's sit down and hammer this out. We're going to listen to one another. We're going to get past this. And we're going to operate with faith in God. We're concerned about glorifying God, doing his will. And we're optimistic that we can glorify God and we can accomplish, great things with his help. And so we make a plan and we listen to one another. We can encourage others to do things that are difficult. We can encourage one another. Or we can be like Sanballat, and Tobiah. We can discourage people from working. So which one describes you and me? So that's one thing that I wanted to say. And the next thing I wanted to say, we've kind of already said this. If a work has been put to the test, you know, if a plan, if an idea has been put to the test and it has found to be good according to God, it is found to be needed for the people of God, then let's do it. And we won't let the enemies of God, we won't let complainers stop us. Nothing will stop us once a work has been tested and found to be good. We learn all this from Nehemiah. So let's kind of go through chapter 3. I think maybe there's a few things we can see that are helpful to us just quickly. First of all, I want to track the work around the wall. That's one of the reasons I want us to see how extensive this project really was. So if you'll notice in verse 1, Eliashib, the high priest, with his brothers, built the sheep gate. And so here's, just remember, the sheep gate is where the work is starting. And then in verse 1, it describes them consecrating the wall to the Tower of the Hundred and the Tower of Hananeel. So from the sheep gate to the Tower of Hananeel, the work has progressed that far by Eliashib and the priests. And then in verse 3, you see them, it talks about them building the fish gate. They hung its doors with the bolts and the bars. And then in verse 6, they're building the old gate. And then if you'll look in verse, repaired the old gate. In verse 11, they repaired another section and the Tower of Furnaces. Do you see how this plan is laid out according to what appears to be the ancient schematic of the old city? And then you'll notice in verse, I wrote these down, verse 13, Hanun and the inhabitants of Zenoa repaired the valley gate. They built it and hung its doors with its bolts and its bars, and 1,000 cubits of the wall to the refuse gate there in verse 13. And then if you'll notice in verse 14 is the refuse gate. Verse 15, repaired the fountain gate. So they repaired the fountain gate. And beginning here in verse 15, I think we have a number of interior structures that are being described in verses 15 through 25. But in verse 26, we pick up again, and you'll notice it says, the temple servants living in Ophel made repairs as far as the front of the water gate. And then in verse 28, above the horse gate, the priests carried out repairs. And then in verse 29, Zadok, the son of Immer, carried out repairs in front of his house, carried out repairs. Shechaniah, the keeper of the east gate, carried out repairs. And then in verse 31, the inspection gate, which I looked up, this Mifkad gate is thought to be, that's the Mifkad gate, the gate, the mustering gate. These all seem to be the same structure there. So in verse 31, the inspection gate, in front of the inspection gate and as far as the upper room of the corner. And then notice verse 32, between the upper room of the corner and the sheep gate, the goldsmiths and the merchants carried out repairs. And so this work has been organized so thoroughly that every gate and every section of the wall is being worked on simultaneously. It partly explains why the work was completed in such a, you know, surprising, such a short amount of time. And we're going to get into that in our next lesson, Lord willing. But we see kind of, you know, chapter 3, I think that gives us a new picture, a new meaning to the chapter. We see that what it is describing is a thorough plan and an efficient plan. Now, the last thing that I wanted to say about chapter 3 before we close this evening was this was mostly a unified effort. And what I mean by that is, if you notice in verse, I think it's verse 5, this is interesting. You know, this is the kind of thing, you know, you can be remembered. You can be remembered for all sorts of things. You can be remembered on this list as people who were a part of the solution, who contributed to the work, or you could be remembered as someone who would not support the work. In verse 5, the Tekoites were making repairs, but the nobles of the Tekoites did not support the work of their masters. Now, they're the only group of people who are listed and described on this list as people who did not work. However, the Tekoites did work, and they were exceptional. They, in verse 27, later they will be described as repairing another section of the wall. So they repaired this section that's described in chapter 5, and then in verse 27, they're described as repairing another section of the wall. So beyond that exception, what you notice as you read chapter 3 is that you've got the priests involved in the work. You've got goldsmiths involved in the work. City officials, you know, the officials of Jerusalem, the officials of Keilah. There's a number of city officials who are described as, you know, leading a group of workers. In verse 12, you've got a man described as working with his daughters. In verse 17, you've got the Levites. The Levites, who were religious teachers, they did religious work. They offered sacrifices, and I'm sure they could do a number of things. But, you know, their livelihood was supposed to be as religious leaders and teachers, the priests and the Levites. You know, if you were in Jerusalem, you know, I used this example with my girls earlier. If you were in Jerusalem in 445 BC and you needed to repair a wall, the priests were probably not the people that you were thinking of. Who am I going to get to build this wall? Well, I know who we'll get. We'll get the goldsmiths. We'll get the merchants. But what we see in this incredible project is the people are united in the work. And I think what Nehemiah realizes himself was not only would he need God's help, but he would need many, many people's help. And we see a special work being accomplished because of the interest and the participation of so many people. Some things that can't be done by one person. And that is true. That was true for Nehemiah's wall. And that is true for the work of local churches, I would say, today. There are some things that local churches need to do that one person can't do. And I would say that even the jobs that one person can't do, there needs to be an awareness about what each person is able to do, what each person is doing, and what each person may need. Let me just say that most churches probably are not in the middle of an emergency right now. I don't want to sound like an alarmist here, but I do believe that every church needs to go down the roll, so to speak, on a regular basis and think about where each person is on the list. Where are they in their lives spiritually? What are their unique needs? Do they have some need right now that is not being met? What are their unique abilities and how are they being utilized on a regular basis? I believe that's one way that churches can avoid finding themselves in an emergency. And who does this? Well, anybody could do it, but I do believe that this is especially and maybe even primarily the work of leaders. It's why God appointed leaders in the Old Testament. There were priests and Levites responsible for teaching the people the law and distinguishing between the clean and the unclean. There were kings that were vested with, you know, authority was vested in them by God, and it was their job to lead according to the law and to, you know, to represent, you know, to be God's spokesman and to, you know, to exercise the authority of the law and to enforce it in justice and consistency. Today in local churches, we have elders. And, you know, one of the reasons it is important for elders, the leaders, to ask these questions is because there has to be a little bit of trust and understanding. These aren't comfortable questions. You know, these aren't questions that are easy to ask. And they're questions that some people don't want us, they don't want anybody to ask these questions. Because if the elders, you know, start asking these questions, then they're going to see maybe some things in my life. And I don't want people to see that, and I don't want to be called out for it. But they needed that in the Old Testament. We need that today. And so, sure, anybody could ask these questions. And we don't need the elders' permission to be encouragers. But you know, I do believe a church that has agreed to get work together, there is a need for on a regular basis for the leaders to just go down the list and look at each person. What are we thinking about this person right now? What's the latest? You know, how are they doing? How are they involved? Are they being utilized? Are we, you know, if you've got a talented person out there who's not being utilized, they're going to be bored to death. You know, they're going to be sitting there wishing, and they may be a little, you know, they may deal with some, they may deal with some contentment issues. You know, it's not just the people who might be having, you know, spiritual weakness. It's the, you know, the people with abilities need to be utilized. It's good for the church. And so most churches probably aren't in the middle of an emergency right now, but how do you avoid an emergency? You think about this regularly. We imitate the example of Nehemiah, planning, prayer, faith, optimism, talking, thinking about what people are doing, wise leadership. As Nehemiah, that's one of the things you want to learn about leadership. I think we learn a lot about leadership from Ezra and Nehemiah. Wise leadership seeks to utilize the abilities of every person, and those who are diligent will find ways to contribute to the Lord's work. So someone says, you know, this church doesn't have elders, or you know, someone, you know, may, you know, there is a reason we have leaders. We need leaders. They have a special responsibility to ask these questions. But at the same time, that doesn't excuse us. If we feel underutilized, it doesn't excuse us. You know, we have a responsibility. Hey, I want to do more. I think I can do more. What do you have for me? I want to contribute to the work. What can I do? But like we already said, there's so many things that we can do that we don't need to ask anyone's permission to do those things, to be encouragers, to contact, to send messages. And that kind of those kinds of things matter. And being intentional about the relationships in the local church is a big deal. You know, we think that those relationships just happen sometimes, maybe, but they don't. It doesn't. So I will... you know, leave you with those thoughts. I hope that our study together with you this evening has been helpful and kind of, you know, wet your palate, and you're looking forward to what else we have to consider together in the book of Nehemiah. Thankful for those who are able to join us this evening. Let's conclude with a word of prayer. Lord willing, on Sunday evening, we'll continue in the book of Nehemiah, picking up in chapter 4, going chapters 4 through 6. So let's have a word of prayer. Our God and our Father in heaven, we praise you and acknowledge you as our maker, the one who is in control of the universe, the one who has the power to give good gifts to your people, the one who shows mercy and kindness to all in this life, sending your rain on the just and on the unjust. And we pray that as your people, especially, Father, we might recognize the good things in our lives as gifts from your hand, that we would accept those gifts with gratitude, that we would seek to use them well for your purposes. And Father, that you would help us to help us to be concerned about your glory, to be concerned about your work, to live by faith in your power, to help us and be with us to accomplish great works, to help us accomplish things that bring honor and glory to your name and help spread your glory farther in the community around us. And just pray that you'd help us to be concerned about our relationships and our work together as a local church, to be intentional about that. Pray that you would help our leaders to be wise, to ask questions, and to evaluate the members individually, what they need, what they can do, and how they can be involved. And you just bless them with wisdom, zeal, and humility as they ask those questions and have those conversations, and pray that you would help us to be humble as well, Father, as they come to us, maybe asking us to be involved or to check on us spiritually, that we wouldn't be hurt or offended by that. We would appreciate that and realize that they're just trying to do what God has called them to do, and they are trying to show us that they care about us and they care about the Lord's work. We're thankful for Jesus Christ, his blood, his death that brings us together, and the hope of his resurrection that unites us in our work while we're here on the earth. Pray that you'd help us to remember his sacrifice. Remember that we need Jesus every day. We need mercy. We need your word to guide us. We pray that you would forgive us and cleanse us and give us strength as we go throughout the rest of this week. We ask that you would continue to be with Kesley, thankful for her recent transfer, and just pray that her therapy will go well. You'll help her to improve, and that you would bless her, thankful for how far she's come already. Ask that you would continue to be with Jean as she goes through her therapy, strengthen her and help her to recover and to be able to be home soon. Pray, Father, that you would also be with our shut-ins, be with some of those who are not necessarily shut in, but because of their susceptibility to this virus, they have been limited, and just ask that you'd bless them, bless their families as they care for them. We pray all these things in Jesus' name, and amen. Okay, brethren, hope that you have a good week, and may the Lord bless you.